Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I don't know if you'd call it a failing grade, but the panel that's in charge of keeping an eye on what Treasury's doing with that $700 billion issued its first report today.
Not satisfied.
All right, maybe it is an F. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 10th of December. Glad you could be with us. 2.5 months after they gave Henry Paulson $700 billion, lawmakers made it clear today they're having some second thoughts. The occasion was a hearing of the House Financial Services Committee. Members gave Assistant Treasury Secretary Neel Kashkari, he's the guy who's running the TARP as it's known, they gave him the once-over. And then they heard from their own team, the Congressional Oversight Panel for Economic Stabilization. That's the board that Congress set up when they passed the bailout. Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren chairs the panel. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Generally speaking, how satisfied is your panel with what the Treasury Department's been doing?
Not satisfied.
Well, what should they be doing better then?
What we're going to start with is a lot of questions. We have questions about what's going on here. Does the Treasury really have a strategy? Is the strategy working? Is it helping reduce foreclosures? How's the taxpayer money being used? What's the Treasury doing to help American families and small businesses? Until we get some real answers, we can't be satisfied. I mean, this is a lot of money.
What's the biggest problem, would you say?
The biggest problem, as I see it right now, is there's no coherent strategy. It's not possible to see, here's what we're going to do, here's how we're going to get the economy back on its feet. Right now, the strategy seems to be we'll stuff some money into banks and let the banks put it in their vaults. And that's somehow going to make the economy do okay. And I don't think that's right.
How big a deal do you think it is that the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, has effectively changed his mind a couple of times about what he's going to do with this money?
Well, given that Treasury explained to us that the principal goal here was confidence, I have to say I don't think that was confidence-inspiring, particularly because there was no identification either of specific facts that had changed, nor was there any articulation of, well, the reason we're not going over here and going over there is because we have this better idea.
Well, then what should the Treasury Department be doing? If your panel could write the rules, what would you have them do?
Right now, what we'd have them do is we just have them answer the questions that we've asked. And if Treasury starts by answering those questions, then we'll be a lot further down the road, both to understanding what they have in mind and being able to evaluate whether or not the money is being spent in the right way.
How should this TARP be working?
There has to be an overall notion that we're going to deal with the genuine economic problems in the United States right now. So, for example, we're having a real problem, a real visible problem in the housing market right now. And we've got potentially $700 billion commitment of American dollars out there for which right now it's not being used. There's not even a hint that it's going to be used to address any part of that problem. That tells me there's not a coherent strategy here. You know, if the American family fails, then there won't be any banks to save. This isn't about saving banks individually. Ultimately, this is about saving our economy, saving our country, but most of all, saving our people.
Elizabeth Warren chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel for the Treasury Department's TARP program. She's got a day job, too. She's a professor of law at Harvard University. Professor Warren, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Shifting gears now to that other bailout, plans to rescue Detroit keep limping along. A number of Senate Republicans said today they're going to filibuster a deal that's been hammered out between congressional Democrats and the White House. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Republican Senator Richard Shelby today made no secret of his opposition to a congressional bailout of U.S. automakers.
This is only delaying their funeral.
Lots of lawmakers are opposed to the bailout on ideological grounds. Michelle Krebs of EdmondsAutoObserver.com says regional politics are also at play. especially for Shelby. His home state of Alabama has spent millions convincing foreign automakers to build plants there.
I think he's protecting his home base of automakers, just as our Michigan delegation are protecting theirs.
Shelby denies that. Peter Hastings is an auto industry analyst with Morgan Keegan. He points out that Alabama's tax breaks are not unusual. Domestic automakers get them, too.
Pretty much every time a major company decides to go and look for a new facility, that's part of the sweetener.
Hastings says the bailout wouldn't give domestic automakers an unfair advantage because it's aimed at helping the entire U.S. economy, not just Detroit. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There are reports today that the Federal Reserve is talking to Congress about plans to start issuing its own debt, that is, selling bonds to raise cash. That caught our attention because it's an interesting idea, but mostly because the Federal Reserve can pretty much create all the money it needs. But Marketplace's Steve Henn explains the financial crisis has already tested the Fed's considerable powers and now sent it scrambling for more.
If you could print your own money, why would you borrow it? Alan Blinder's the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. He says even though the Fed can create its own money, it doesn't always want to.
As you create money, you create the potential financial tinder for inflation in the future.
But recently, the Fed's created a lot of new cash. As Wall Street imploded, the Federal Reserve became the lender of last resort. It bought short-term corporate debt and propped up companies like AIG and Citibank. The total tab? $1.2 trillion and rising. At first, the Fed financed these bailouts by borrowing close to $500 billion from the U.S. Treasury. But in November, Treasury cried uncle.
There's a legal limit on how much money the Treasury is allowed to borrow, the national debt ceiling.
And Treasury was about to hit it. Since then, the Fed's had to create new money to finance new bailouts. And economist Alan Meltzer says in the long run, that's a problem.
A big one.
How big?
Very, very.
Because if inflation ignites, the Fed will have to raise interest rates again.
There'll be pressures on them from the Congress not to do it. There'll be pressures on them from the market not to do it. That's not going to be an easy thing to do. They're not very adept at doing those things.
Which is why he and Blinder believe the Fed's looking to finance any future bailouts without printing more cash. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Speaking of financing bailouts, as we are, that item we mentioned yesterday about interest rates on Treasury bills dropping to zero or below is playing out some more today. One reason why it happened and why it might not be such a good thing if it keeps on happening. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Treasury bills are essentially a short-term loan to the U.S. government. Investors usually buy them at a discount, say 97 cents on the dollar, and then make a small profit when the government pays them back at full price. Even in the best of times, they're not big moneymakers for investors, but they are considered very, very safe. This week, the bills were essentially getting no yield at all, and in some cases, investors were even paying more than face value for the bills.
That's more or less the equivalent of paying rent on a safe deposit box to put your cash in.
Lou Crandall is chief economist at research firm Wrightson ICAP. This week's rush on Treasury bills came mostly from money market funds. They're supposed to invest in extremely safe things like commercial paper, which is issued by companies, or short-term municipal bonds, which are issued by cities. But these days, even those kinds of investments can feel a little risky. David Kovacs is chief investment officer at Turner Investment Partners.
The anxiety has caused investors to come out of these types of money market funds and into the only entity that appears to guarantee its obligations, and that's the U.S. government.
Stashing money in Treasury bills might make investors feel better, but it's not necessarily good, since all the money the Fed's putting into the system is ending up back in Treasuries instead of in the broader economy. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
One more thought on that story. Imagine you're the Treasury Secretary and you had to finance, trillions to bail out the economy. Doing it interest-free is not such a bad thing, right? On Wall Street today, nothing. No fireworks, no wild swings, just a relatively stable day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. It's been a while, hasn't it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the economy the way it is, frugality has taken on a whole new shine. Recycling, with its deep conservation ethic, is more popular now than it's ever been. But those crushed cans and cardboard boxes don't recycle themselves, you know. They're part of a huge global market that's built on one thing, a booming economy. Now, recyclers can't give the stuff away. It's gotten so bad that here in California, the State Waste Management Board held an emergency session today to figure out what to do with it all. But there could be a silver, or shall we say a green lining. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The Port of Long Beach is the nerve center for global recycling. Here, just south of Los Angeles, all the stuff we throw into our recycle bins is loaded into hundreds of thousands of containers every year. It's all bound for China, where old pizza boxes and plastic bottles are given new life as packaging for all the products coming back. But as the economy tanked, so did demand. Gilbert Dodson runs a recycling export business in Long Beach.
Everyone got scared, and I mean, the orders just absolutely stopped.
As a result, prices for recyclable materials plunged.
So all of a sudden, the stuff's worthless. And matter of fact, you have to charge a customer to pick it up, so you break even. And I mean, you can see it killed the industry. It just, the last 2 months have been just bedlam.
Dodson now leases warehouse space to store thousands of truck-sized bales of paper and crushed cans until the market recovers. City governments don't have that choice. As prices rose, many expanded their recycling programs. And with so much material coming in, they're now forced to sell at a loss. Alex Halu is with the Los Angeles Bureau of Sanitation.
Back in 2007, people were talking about recycling being recession-proof. And that really has proved it's not completely accurate.
Halu says unlike many other cities, Los Angeles negotiated a minimum floor price for its recyclables. And it's lucky it did.
If we did not structure the contracts, we would be probably in the loss of about maybe $5 million a year.
That doesn't mean L.A. is off the hook. It still costs the city's taxpayers tens of millions of dollars a year to keep all the recycling trucks and sorting operations going. And that's just one city. Heidi Sanborn with the California Product Stewardship Council calls local trash removal one of the largest corporate welfare programs of modern times.
There's no feedback mechanism to the producers to design anything different than whatever the heck they want that can litter and cause all kinds of environmental problems and public health problems. And they're not feeling any pain for this at all. Local governments are.
And in a time of tight budgets, many of those local governments are asking why taxpayers and not the companies that make all those products are the ones paying to get rid of them. L.A. Sanitation's Alex Helu says this is where the financial crisis may be a force for change.
This actually gives us an opportunity right now to relook at our old system as a whole and come up with a solution to address the recycling issues.
One solution would come in the form of state laws requiring manufacturers to cover the cost of disposal. California, Washington, and a few other states are considering legislation that would do just that, but some companies have beat them to it. At a warehouse north of Sacramento, computer maker Hewlett-Packard takes back its old products and grinds them into raw materials for new ones. Last year, the company recycled the computer equivalent of twice the weight of the Titanic. HP's director of sustainability, Bonnie Nixon, says that simple change, taking end-of-life responsibility for what they sell, has transformed the way HP makes things.
We design our products to use fewer materials. We make them easier to disassemble and recycle, and we allow for more effective reuse of those materials.
Nixon says HP's recycling operation is yet to turn a profit, but the company plans to stick with it. She says in a world of diminishing resources, it's only a matter of time before prices rise again. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Sam took his camera with him while he was reporting that story for us. Check out the slideshow on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, who can religious charities hire?
For many faith groups, it just doesn't make sense to say, sure, you can take part as a faith group, but by the way, get rid of what makes you a faith group.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 0.8% today, 70 points to close at 8,761. The NASDAQ finished up 1.1%, 18 points, ended at 1,565. The S&P 500 tacked on nearly 1.2%, 10 points, finished at 899. Uncertainty over the bailout had auto stock shifting gears all day. In the end, General Motors reversed just over 2%, but Ford pulled up nearly 2/3 of 1%. Rising crude prices fueled energy shares today. Chevron bubbled up 3.8%. ExxonMobil gained 2.3%. Coal producers also fired up some big gains. Peabody Energy stoked up more than 19% today. Massey Energy gained over 15%. CONSOL Energy rose more than 13% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.70%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. What's the connection between champagne and collateralized debt obligations? Head on over to our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos uncorking the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases monthly trade figures for October. The House Appropriations Committee holds a hearing on the Economic Recovery Bill. And the Senate Homeland Security Committee discusses World at Risk, a report from the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. With apologies to Benjamin Franklin, there are only three things in this life that are certain: death, taxes, and a really big stimulus package sometime early next year. The president-elect himself said so in his radio address this past weekend. Still, commentator David Frum doesn't think it's such a great idea.
Barack Obama is collecting accolades for his super smart economic team. Now let's see what this super smart team wants to do. The president-elect tells us he is planning a huge new spending program, vast subsidies for alternative energy, renovation money for school buildings, grants to local governments for construction projects on a scale that would impress the pharaohs. Altogether, a stimulus budget as big as the Interstate Highway Program. These are not initiatives to last a season or two. And while they are all packaged together as stimulus, most of them will start, and most of the bills will arrive, long after the economic crisis ends. Without much debate, Americans are undertaking a grand generational commitment. We are redirecting the economy away from competition and toward government oversight on a scale not seen since World War II. We are building a much more tightly concentrated banking system, a few colossal national financial institutions with a seat for government at the board table. We are effectively nationalizing the automobile industry. These are steps very easy to take that will be very difficult to undo. And we are doing it all with trillions of borrowed dollars. These new debts will accrue just as the old debts to finance the retirement of the baby boomers begin to come due. The future public finances of the United States look grim even before the announcement of Obama's big plans. Now the fiscal future looks desperate. Barack Obama suggests he can pay for his plans by cutting back on Iraq spending. Okay, that'll support the first couple of months. He has talked about rolling back the Bush tax cuts and maybe increasing the income limits for Social Security taxes. There's a few months more. So what's the plan? There is no plan. We are just assuming that we can continue borrowing forever, refinancing as necessary. Wait a minute. Isn't that how we got into this mess?
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Share your thoughts with us about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Lean times mean a lot of us are trying to stretch our budgets and, given the season, trying to stretch our charitable contributions, too. Because as great as it feels to get, it can feel even better to give.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
Today, as we continue our look at philanthropy, how we can put our dollars to work more effectively. If there is less money to donate this year, should you give your time and just volunteer? Holden Karnofsky is the founder of GiveWell.net. That's a nonprofit charity evaluation website. Holden, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
As people look to cut back in this economy, and philanthropy is going to be one of those areas, does it make sense to volunteer time instead of money?
Well, I would actually make a different suggestion. I would say that if you're finding yourself this year with more time and less money than you usually have, I would encourage you to put that time into researching and really thinking hard about where you're giving rather than volunteering. I think volunteering is often advertised as being more than it is for a very specific reason, which is that volunteering is often about recruiting donors. And so what I would say is there's some volunteer work that's certainly valuable, especially if you have a particular skill, such as, let's say you're a cleft palate surgeon and you're going over to perform corrective surgeries. But a lot of the time, when a charity's asking you to volunteer, what they're really trying to do is get you involved, get you excited, and the real benefit to them is the donation anyway.
All right, well, let's get to the econometrics here then. How do I know what to look for when I want to maximize the charitable return on my dollar?
Right, well, it all depends what you're aiming for. And but the general advice I'd give is I would just try and go out there and really push charities to say, all right, what's the evidence that this is changing people's lives for the better? And a lot of times, programs that sound really good in theory just don't turn out to have the impacts you would hope for in practice.
There is obviously a set of criteria that you guys look at. What are the top couple? I would imagine it's administrative overhead versus amount actually given. It's staff versus volunteers, those sorts of things.
Actually, we don't like to emphasize the administrative overhead aspect because we think that, for one thing, it's often a distraction. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at a problem if you're not doing a good job of it and if you're not taking the right approach. And a lot of times taking the right approach means being able to measure what you're doing and learn from it, which often, depending on how the accountants want to do things, gets classified as overhead. So we actually feel that when people insist that as many pennies of my dollar as possible need to go straight to the children, what they're doing is they're leaving out a lot of the overhead that's needed to hire great people, to do self-evaluation, to figure out what really works, and to do a good job.
What about newer charities that are just getting off the ground and maybe don't have the data trail that would let you figure out whether they're worth it or not?
Well, in my opinion, there's a lot of those charities out there that may be doing great work. And if you are close enough to one that you've really seen it and you're very connected to it, then that may be all you need to have a lot of confidence that they're doing good. But, you know, if you're not in that position and you're trying to find a charity that you can have confidence in that you haven't heard much about, I think it's the wrong approach to try and guess yourself which of these new unproven charities really has what it takes. I think you're much better off with a bigger, more established one. And I think that oftentimes in charity, there's too much discussion given to the next big, great revolutionary idea that's going to solve the root cause of poverty, and not nearly enough attention given to, hey, what are the things that already work and how can we do more of them?
Holden Karnofsky is the co-founder of GiveWell.net. That's a group that studies the effectiveness of charities and advises donors about that. Holden, thanks a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's not just donors asking big questions this holiday season. Some charities have big concerns as well, religious organizations in particular. Back during the campaign, Barack Obama said he'll expand the government support for them that President Bush started, with one change. He'll prevent religious organizations that take taxpayer money from refusing to hire employees who aren't Christian. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Each day, about 3,000 kids from low-income families get a free meal from the Shepherd Community Center, a Christian charity in Indianapolis. Jay Height is the center's director.
The tragedy of hunger in America is that 8 out of 10 kids in this neighborhood will not get two meals a day if they're not at school.
3 years ago, Shepherd Community got a federal grant to expand its capacity. That money is about to run out, and the center would like to reapply for another contract. But Jay Height says he won't if the next president does what he says he'll do, prohibit Shepherd from hiring only Christian employees.
We do what we do out of our faith. That is what drives us. And we would expect those who serve alongside us to share that faith. And so we would not pursue any kind of funding that would limit our ability to do that.
Before President Bush's faith-based initiative, the government didn't specifically recruit religious groups to provide social services, but that changed under Bush, who set up an office to promote partnerships for community services like homeless shelters. The religious organizations wanted the right to hire only like-minded workers.
For a faith group, faith is what defines who they are and why they do what they do and so on.
That's Stanley Carlson Teese at the Christian think tank Center for Public Justice. The Bush administration exempted religious groups from civil rights laws that ban discrimination on the basis of religion, race, or gender. Now President-elect Obama says he'll reverse the Bush policy and require non-discriminatory hiring. Carlson T. says that change will chase religious institutions away from government service.
And so for many faith groups, it just doesn't make sense to say, sure, you can take part as a faith group, but by the way, get rid of what makes you a faith group.
But Robert Tuttle, a law professor at George Washington University, says even in cases where Congress insisted on non-discriminatory hiring by government contractors, the Bush administration defended hiring on the basis of religion as legal.
The debate over faith-based hiring is really an offshoot of the debate about how much government should be involving intensively religious organizations and social welfare services. Once you have organizations that see not just sort of the provision of services, but the transformation of souls as a core part of it, then this conversation or this debate is going to come along with it.
President-elect Obama headed a religious community group himself back in the 1980s and says he'll increase funding for faith-based service providers, but only if they accept hiring rules just like everybody else. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we'll find out what happens when charities that can't fail worry they might.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, seconds matter, even in high finance, maybe especially in high finance. The Labor Department said today that last Friday's unemployment report was released 30 seconds earlier than it should have been. That's 8:30 Washington time. You think back to how lousy that report was, more than 500,000 jobs gone, and you can imagine why a leak might matter. 30 seconds worth of trading with information not too many other people know to be looking for. The department said it has fixed what was a technical glitch. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today the Dow rose 0.8%, 70 points. The Nasdaq pumped up 0.1%, 18 points. The S&P 500 tacked on about 0.2%, 10 points. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, an inside take on the bust in commercial real estate.
It's impossible to time the bottom. What you want to do is be generally correct.
It's another conversation from the corner office. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.